You're listening to PetLifeRadio.com.
Is your pet stressed out? Does your pet need annual vaccines? Which pet is best for a child? Would you know if your dog was in pain? Pet Life Radio presents The Pet Doctor, where you'll learn everything about keeping your pet healthy and happy. From pet care, pet meds and grooming, to pet food, pet insurance and dental care, this is the place to find out everything there is to know about pet wellness. Whether you have a dog, cat, reptile or rabbit, you'll find answers for your pets straight from the vets, because it's your pet. Health matters. Please welcome your Pet Doctor host, veterinary media consultant and veterinarian, Dr. Bernadine Cruz.
Ever wonder why the giant panda is black and white? As legend goes, long ago when pandas lived in the mountains of Tibet, they were snow white. The bears befriended a group of female shepherdess who often played with their cubs when they tended their flocks. When a leopard attempted to attack one of the cubs, the women sacrificed themselves, sparing the young bear. The pandas mourned the shepherdess by following the local custom of wearing black ashes on their arms. In their grief, they cried and rubbed their eyes with ash-coated paws, covered their ears to block the sound of their sorrow, and hugged each other, leaving them with the black and white pattern we see to this day. Giant pandas are native to China and are considered a national symbol of peace and harmony. Sadly, it's estimated there are only about 1,000 of these bears in the world. When I recently toured China, I was fortunate to visit the Chengdu research base of giant panda breeding. My guest today is Dr. Sarah Bexel, the chief director of the Department of Conservation at the Chengdu research base. Her focus is keeping mankind from having to wear black ashes on their arms for these marvelous creatures. We'll be right back after this short break.
Please have a seat in the waiting room. The doctor will be with you shortly, right after these messages.
It's hard to find time for your furry family member. That's where Camp Bow Wow comes in. All day play and overnight camp, daycare and boarding for dogs. Everything is included. Large play areas for fun and exercise. Spacious cabins, comfy cots, even live camper cams to watch from a computer or smartphone. Camp Bow Wow offers the best care and is the place to go where a dog can be a dog. For locations and more information, visit campbowwow.com.
Let's Talk Pets on PetLifeRadio.com. Welcome back to The Pet Doctor on Pet Life Radio with Dr. Bernadine Cruz. The doctor is in and we'll see you now.
Dr. Bexel, what a fabulous job you have there. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Bernadine. It's my pleasure.
Now, give us a little background and how did you get this fabulous job of being there at the Chengdu Research Base?
Yeah, I think, of course, I think in any job, there's always a little bit of luck involved, but probably
and hard work.
Hard work, yes. So I, at the time that I was initially asked to go to China, it was 1999, I had been working with another critically endangered species and the national treasure of the country of Brazil. That species is the golden lion tamarin.
They're awesome.
Very beautiful.
Yes.
And very charismatic and extremely endangered. Their numbers are not that different from that of the giant panda. And my focus had been in my career at that point been on animal behavior. And so when it came time that Zoo Atlanta needed another behavioral researcher to jump in while our original researcher, Dr. Rebecca Snyder, stayed back home to finish writing up her dissertation. My name was thrown into the kitty, and I was chosen, very luckily, for kind of three reasons. One is that I had studied abroad when I was an undergraduate, so I was kind of familiar with China and Chinese culture. Also, I mean, very, very surface level, of course, at that point. Another was that I had a dual background in both science education as well as in animal behavior. And our Chengdu colleagues were very interested in starting a conservation education department. So I went to continue Dr. Snyder's work, but with a dual purpose of seeing if we could start conservation education programs for giant pandas.
And looking at your bio, having this PhD in early childhood education, it seems like it's a wonderful, as you're saying, just a perfect tie-in for you. I always love how science and our degrees can open up so many different doors.
Yeah, yeah. You know, my undergraduate degree is in biology and environmental studies. My master's degree was in biological anthropology, which of course focuses on mostly on primates. That's part of that degree, you know, expertise. But then what I learned while I was working on my master's degree in biological anthropology, that was actually the first time in my entire life that I had ever heard of an endangered species. I grew up loving animals, wanting to commit my life to them, but this was the early 90s, and it was just at that point in time that we were really, I think, scientists knew. But the general public was kind of kept in the dark. And what I realized, and of course, golden-eyed tamarins, even at that point in time, were extremely endangered. And quite frankly, I was first sad and disappointed in my own species, but boy, was I angry. And that's when I made the switch. I was like, wow, well, you know, we need to educate people. We need to help people understand what's happening out there in the wild for these animals. And my hope at that time, and I still keep trying, but it was a very naive hope, I think, back then, is that if we provided education for people, that they would change their behavior and save space for wildlife. That is not a fight that I have yet won, and I have many colleagues also obviously fighting this fight with me. So, yeah, I think what has happened over the past few years is that we've just become, our messages have to be stronger and more urgent. So crafting those in ways that people can accept, I have really fallen back on my degrees in education to do that.
And there's so many people, and I love the fact that you're trying to educate the children, because I think sometimes adults are beyond saving. We are set in our ways, and we have our attitudes that, oh, it's just one more stupid insect. It's just one more creature. There's lots more out there. Why do we need to be concerned about them? Because I need to be more concerned about myself. How do you phrase this for children so they see the interdependence, the need to be conservative and being stewards of the world?
Yeah, well, we spend a lot of time on basically facilitating what we call the human-animal bond, because your radio program speaks to that all the time. I know you're very familiar with that, and your listeners as well. But we try to do that with wild animals as well. It's very easy for children to form very close bonds with dogs and cats and guinea pigs and other animals that share our homes with us. But it's a different sort of strategy and thought process to get them to bond with wildlife and bond so dearly and so closely that they want to protect them. So we spend a lot of time just helping them to understand the behavior of animals, what their species-specific needs are, and very much the emotional lives of animals. When I first started in this field, that was taboo to talk about. That was just 20 years ago. I was trained heavily to never, ever talk about the emotional lives of animals, which now sounds so archaic, but it was just what we were taught. We were told that you never talked about that. But now, of course, we've got amazing scientists like Jane Goodall, Diane Fossey, Katie Moss, you know, these people who have spent their entire lives out in the wild with animals, and we know that animals, it's scientifically proven, of course, that they have emotions. And so we need to let children know that they're just very similar to us. And that's easy for children. They see it. They're indoctrinated, actually, to not see it, part of the adults in their lives. And so we spend a lot of time on that. Then we spend time on species-specific needs, and that's very important. You know, it's not that just that animals need food and water, you know, a tree to sleep in. There's lots that more that goes with that. And then we try not to scare them too much, because we don't want to scare children about some of these very sad issues. But we talk about how it's important to share with other animals. So a way to do that is to help them make the connection that our consumptive patterns are basically taking away resources for other animals. And so children very often naturally, I mean, obviously we can't do this with impoverished children because that's not fair, but with especially nations where we have more than enough, it's teaching children to share, and that's something that's part of their repertoire of learning, of course. We all remember being taught to share, but they really want to share with animals. So that gives us a little glimmer of hope. But if we train them young to share and to not consume so much, like you said, that's much easier than talking to adults because, like you said, we're set in our ways and we don't want to sacrifice. But children, if they grow up that way, it's more of a natural progression.
So Sarah, what is so frustrating at times is many people are opposed to having zoos. They find that zoos are definitely abnormal. An animal is supposed to be in the wild. They're supposed to be able to interact with the nature in a way that they can't do in a cage, that they can't do in even the environment that's as enriched as you can. What are your views on zoos?
I'm pretty much in the boat that you just described. While I do have a history working in zoos, and I learned a lot in the 10 years I worked in the zoo system, I am a person that I hope that zoos radically change, or it would be great if we didn't need them. I don't think it's appropriate for us to keep animals in cages. It's just wrong. We know enough about their needs, both emotionally and physically, to know that it's not an appropriate place to keep them.
With that being said, talk about the Chengdu research base, because that is doing such marvelous work for these endangered animals.
It's a very much a double-edged sword, Bernadine. I think that for a long time, we really assumed that captive breeding of wild animals with the intention of putting them back in the wild was, you know, obviously always seen as the last-ditch effort because of the amount of money and just, you know, there's cruelty inherent in that, not intentional, of course, and you know, money and also just intellect. It's, you know, it takes some of our top scientists to try to figure out these problems. And I've worked with three species now where all those types of scientists had to come together, the black-footed ferret, the golden lion tamarin, the giant panda. They've all been forced into the same boat of our last-ditch efforts being captive breeding and reintroduction programs. The issue with it is that reintroduction of mammals is not very often successful, or if it's successful, it's very fleeting, extremely fleeting. Like when I left the golden lion tamarin program, all parks are all, you know, the habitat for golden lion tamarins was at capacity. We were starting to talk about their population as being as stable as it could ever be. But, of course, the populations of Brazil, the human population, hasn't been going down. It's only been growing exponentially. And, of course, they're becoming a much richer country, so their consumption is going up as well. So, you know, animals then start losing ground because even those short-term gains are just absolutely minuscule in comparison to the force of humanity when our population has reached this size and still growing exponentially, and that our entire, you know, sort of mantra as a species is consume, 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 consume. So my problem with captive breeding and reintroduction programs is that maybe, for some species, maybe, but I'd have to be sold on them, could be successful. But the only way they can be successful is that if humans finally started realizing that we can't grow our population anymore, that we need to stabilize it and then actually start decreasing the human population naturally and humanely, of course, by no draconian measures or, you know, cruel measures, absolutely. And we have to decrease our consumption. Otherwise, it's just a game in futility. It's putting species in a holding pattern, putting them through very cruel procedures. And when most of them are reintroduced, many of them don't make it. And, you know, people don't realize that. So I now am, just through 20 years of experience, I'm really asking the world to question these strategies. And maybe what we need to do is focus all of our scientific intellect, our educational intellect, our moral capacities, our common sense, quite frankly, and really face bigger issues that now are putting, you know, even the survival of humanity in the balance. You know, we're just a mammal. We're not. We also have to rely on these natural resources. And if we use them all up, we won't live through this. We won't live through ourselves. So.
Well, this is an uplifting educational discussion we're having right now.
Sorry, I definitely am not one of the uplifting people.
But it's really one of the eye-opening, because education, as you're saying, is so critically important that we realize it's not just, oh, it's that warm feel-good of trying to save a species. It's really trying to save a globe.
All of us are included.
Let's maybe turn this around and be a little bit more light and enjoyable of talking about these marvelous creatures that you had the opportunity to try and still are trying to educate the world about and the Chinese people, the giant panda. Number one, we talk about the giant panda. Please tell our listeners there's other types of pandas too.
Yeah, there are. It's kind of a misnomer, or I don't know if it's incorrect, but it's a strange phenomenon. of just language, human language, that we have red pandas and giant pandas. They are in different family groups. The giant panda, now we know, because we're able to look at DNA evidence, that they are a part of the Ursidae family, which is all of the bears. There's only 8 bear species in the world right now, and giant pandas are one of them. And then the red pandas, they're cute little cousins. They're definitely not close relatives. Are actually in the Prasinidae family with a lot of the other ring-tailed animals, such as alingos and raccoons. But what has been so interesting about these two species, especially in China, is that they share the exact same habitat. So they, almost through a process of sort of parallel evolution, you know, through time, they've both adapted to being bamboo eaters. Both of them, their diet is 99% of is bamboo. They also have very similar breeding patterns. They, you know, share the exact same habitat. But what's interesting is with the red pandas is they tend to be more arboreal and they spend a lot of time in the trees, whereas giant pandas are terrestrial. So they can sort of cohabitate in peace, even though they eat the same food and share the same habitat. So, yeah.
I think what a lot of as well. Oh, they're both just gorgeous. And at the Chengdu Research Base, they happen to have both. You could actually enjoy seeing both of them. I'm speaking right now with Dr. Sarah Bexel. She is the Chief Director of Department of Education at the Chengdu Research Base in Chengdu, China. We'll be right back after the short break and talk about the giant panda. We'll be right back.
Please have a seat in the waiting room. The doctor will be with you shortly, right after these messages.
Get the stinky dog away from me.
Bad breath and bad gas.
Petey stopped eating. All his hair fell out.
Itching, licking, missing fur.
At least $5,000 in vet bills.
Creams, antibiotics, sprays.
No results.
Everything we tried failed except the Dynavite.
Dinovite. .com.
If you want the dog to be healthy, you got to feed it something healthy.
The omega-3 fatty acids.
Flaxseed, zinc, alfalfa.
The digestive enzymes that are cooked out of regular dog food.
Dynavite is nutrition.
The shedding has stopped and the itching has stopped.
Her coat is not soft. It's silky.
It's healthy and shiny and glossy.
She's got life. She's got energy.
Tons of energy. No more bad smell.
Dynavite's the bomb.
Dynavite is the best thing that's ever happened to my dogs, you know, besides me, of course.
859-428-1000.
859-428-1000.
Dynavite for life.
Dinovite. .com.
Begging to hear more of your favorite show? Full episodes of all our shows are available on demand. Go to PetLifeRadio.com to fetch our entire lineup of Possum Pet Podcasts. Also, dig us up in iHeartRadio Talk and iTunes. Let's talk pets. Live and on demand, only from Pet Life Radio.
Let's talk pets.
Let's talk pets.
On Pet Life Radio.
Pet Life Radio.
PetLifeRadio.com. Welcome back to The Pet Doctor on Pet Life Radio with Dr. Bernadine Cruz. The doctor is in and we'll see you now.
Dr. Bexel, while you were there, what were some of your responsibilities? So education, conservation, maybe I should ask, were the Chinese people receptive to these conservation efforts? Because look, going to some of their cities and you're hearing about the millions and millions of people that live in a city, it's mind-boggling. How can they be concerned? Or it's difficult, it seems, for them to have this conservation mindset when their numbers are so huge.
So I think it's very difficult, I think, for you know, I can only speak for my Chinese friends and colleagues because those are the people that I get to interact with and talk with. You know, I think giant pandas hold a very special place in everybody's heart. You know, I mean, they are a source of pride. Of course, everybody is sort of visually and emotionally attracted to them. And, of course, people want them to survive and to persist. I think where the breakdown in understanding happens is that But I think it's getting better, especially with young people that, you know, that we interact with and work with, is they know that there are limited resources, that we live on a finite planet. And so whereas we do have a very large human population, if we want other animals to persist with us, then we're going to need to make changes. I think that realization is just dawning. So I think there's still going to be a little bit of time needed. You know, when I first started working in China 16 years ago, people were coming out of years of starvation and, you know, very, very minimalistic lifestyles. They didn't have much, and so it's been really exciting for them to finally have enough to, oh my goodness, I can buy a cell phone. I can maybe aspire to own a car, you know, so, but now all of a sudden asking or them realizing, oh, but me wanting and getting all of this stuff is harming some of these animals that I do love and treasure dearly. That is really, really difficult, you know. Do we sacrifice economic progress and material wealth to save other species?
How
that's
endangered
difficult sell in any country.
It is difficult, yes, because they're, as you're saying, trying to survive themselves. How endangered are the giant pandas? Because as I mentioned at the introduction, there's about 1,000. Is that correct?
There are, in our last survey that was done by the Chinese government, there were found to be about 1,800 in the wild.
Okay.
And then we have just over 400 in captivity. So one of the cautions, of course, that we have to say about the giant panda numbers that is morally imperative for us to share with your listeners is we don't necessarily know that the giant panda, because you're right, there was several years there where the estimate was 1,000. So saying that that number is larger, many people want to hail that as a success, and maybe that's true. But also with the advent of all the amazing technology we have at our fingertips now these days, it could just be that we're getting better at counting. So it's not an okay time. It would be very irresponsible for anybody involved in wildlife conservation. The same phenomenon is happening with tigers globally right now, and it's very frustrating to watch where, you know, people say, oh, we've had all this success, you know, we can let our guard down. No, please don't let your guard down. We really are not sure, you know, if their numbers are going up or we just have better technology. And the other issue that I think, again, and I mentioned this early in our conversation, if our human population keeps growing at the rate that it is, and our consumption continues to go up, we will lose ground. We will. There's no way around it. And with climate change and everything else that's going on, the fight is, we're at the very beginning of the battle. Let me just put it that way.
You mentioned climate change, and knowing that pandas eat bamboo, and that's all they eat, and it's amazing to think that an animal as robust as they look are subsisting on merely bamboo. How is global warming, climate change affecting their habitat?
Yeah, it's. I am not exactly an expert at that, so I don't want to misspeak. There are several people who are out there studying that, but the research is very preliminary, I think. The predictions are not good. I mean, it makes perfect sense that it's going to be changing, and what we do know from looking at other species is that animals that live in cooler environments are some of the first to be hard hit. And when you think of giant pandas as now a high altitude species, and with global warming, of course, the warming of the mountains, you know, going up in altitude is changing temperatures and the environment. I haven't read anything yet about it changing the availability of bamboo, but it is already changing temperature. And so there have been other species that have already gone extinct due to climate change because they live at high altitudes. Temperatures are changing. They're forced higher in altitude to maintain just normal body temperature. There's either other species already living there so they can't find their own niche, and then are, you know, the competition between other species that already live at that altitude causes the other animals to die out, or it just gets to be too high and then you hit a certain point where there's no trees and anything to sustain them, and then they lose their habitat, which leads to extinction. So the prediction and the hypotheses are not good, Bernadine, but we don't have the science to know exactly yet, but it's something we have to keep in mind.
So please describe, Dr. Bexell, where the panda, the giant panda, typically lives. So it's bamboo forest, there's snow part of the year. Is it high up? Is it in valleys?
Well, they are an interesting species in that, you know, maybe you've read or you've heard while you were visiting the panda base that they're one of the oldest, they're called a living fossil, one of the oldest mammals on Earth, and have been on our planet for over 8 million years. And so, you know, when people try to talk about them being at their evolutionary dead end, that's really unfair to them. What we do know, and it's because we're forcing them into extinction, they are one of the most adaptable mammals out there, if we're not overtaking their bamboo forests, of course. What we do know from fossil evidence is they used to range even down into the low valleys all the way up until, obviously, the tree line of mountains. Now, of course, because the valleys are what is desirable for human dwellings, they've been forced out of those valleys. So we do think that they would come down into the valleys if they were safe valleys, but they're not safe because there's people there. So they now are ranging higher up in the mountains, usually above about, I think it's 1,200 meters. I'd have to look it up to, you know, be quotable on that.
Hi.
And then up until the tree line, yeah.
And they're in a situation, in an environment where they have the various seasons. People would want to know, do they hibernate like other bears that we'd consider, you know, in that same type of an environment?
Yeah, they do not. They're one of the only bears that do not, but they have a really good reason for it. So in a normal day in the life of a panda, they would spend 55% of their day eating. And as you were alluding to with their dietary choice, they can't put on the fat that a lot of the other bears can when they have an omnivorous diet. And so they literally have to stay awake in order to keep eating all year round. So they're not.
It seems like when I was at least at the research base, they were eating or they were sleeping. They weren't doing much of anything else.
Once they get to adulthood, that is all they do. Yep. They're not lazy. You know, like if you do visit them at a zoo, you will always overhear everybody around you saying, oh my God, they're so lazy. They're always sleeping. They're so boring. And that's really also an unfair statement to say about these amazing beings. What I like to try to help people understand is I have them imagine, what if you could only eat celery for the rest of your life, only were able to eat celery? Very low in calories, very hard to digest. No peanut butter. No, exactly. Just that plant. So imagine after you finally got your caloric intake for the day, if you went out to play, that would be a waste of that energy. So I like to say pandas are energy efficient, but they are not lazy.
And they don't start off as black and white.
Nope. They're little pink fur balls. Very much like a mouse or a rat pinky, if you've ever seen one.
And they are amazingly small when they're born. I was fortunate to see one of the newborns in the incubator when I was there. Over what period of time does it take them to reach their adult size?
They reach probably their adult size probably around 4, but even after 4 years of age, they're still kind of putting on weight and filling out and whatnot. So after their sort of infant stages until about, you know, 6 months and even up to a year, they're still growing very, very rapidly. Then their growth sort of slows down and reach sort of adult weight and size between 5 and 6. And the females become sort of what we call sexually mature, ready for mating around 5 or 6 years of age, and the males between 6 and 7.
How long do they typically live in the wild?
The average, from what we know, they're very elusive and difficult to study, about an average of 20 years in the wild, whereas in captivity, it's closer to 30.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and even older.
That's good. And I know one of the real difficulties is trying to get them to breed in captivity. That's one of the main focuses there at the Chengdu. Of course, that's why it's called a breeding center. What have they learned about them?
Yeah, so there's been a lot of learning, very hard-won learning, about why they are not particularly interested in breeding in captivity. Of course, this is not a phenomenon that afflicts wild pandas. I think many people love to joke about, you know, and use that as an excuse to say they're at their evolutionary dead end. People always say, yeah, they don't even like to breed. But that kind of shows a person's ignorance if they do say something like that, like they maybe skipped biology class in high school. Because if an animal doesn't breed naturally and breed well in the wild, they go extinct. Period, end of story. So this lack of breeding interest is 100% a phenomenon of us taking them out of their natural environment and putting them into captivity. One of the most important aspects of breeding in the wild for them is, of course, choice, and female choice, of course. But during breeding season, what happens is the female will go into estrus, on, of course, emitting all kinds of hormones and pheromones that attract males. And, of course, they're vocalizing and their behavior changes. They're much more active during that time. Males congregate around her, and they literally fight for her, and sometimes brutally fight for her. Then she will go through that mating process with, you know, the strongest male breeds first, and then, quite frankly, she will then copulate with some other males. But what we do know is almost always that first male is the one that fathers the offspring. Now, we can't do all that for them in captivity. And because of that sort of vicious fight for access to a female, so we can't give them choice. We also can't even keep a male and a female in an enclosure with each other for a long period of time because fights do break out and they can very, very seriously injure each other very, very quickly. If the female doesn't like the male, she will definitely...
Tough love, yes.
Yeah, she will be very mean to him, let's just put it that way. And so, but because we've taken away everything that's natural to them about the breeding situation, they just have no interest, absolutely none. And so what the Chengdu Panda Base, as well as Wolong, and now all their pandas have been moved to Bifengxia, what over time they have learned is how to basically artificially help the pandas to breed. There are a few that are really proficient natural breeders, but for the most part, most of those offspring are born due to taking sperm from the males and artificially inseminating the females.
It's a tough way to make babies, but
yeah.
Thank goodness people are able to see them and appreciate them and hopefully realize how important it is to protect them, the giant panda, as well as all the other animals we share our world with. If there was something, Dr. Bexell, that you needed to leave us with, some point of something special about pandas, something unique, what would it be?
I think that they are one of the most stoic, beautiful, not appearance-wise, but in their minds, animals that I've ever had the real privilege to have the chance to work with. They're great mothers. They love their babies. They do everything for those babies. They love each other, and they just want to be left in peace. And I think that we as a species, as humanity, need to do everything in our power. You know, whenever somebody tells me they love giant pandas, I really want to challenge them to say, well, what are you willing to change about your lifestyle so that giant pandas can remain on this planet with us? So I would just encourage people, please, they are worth saving, but we have to have help from everybody. The science cannot save them without everybody.
Dr. Bexell, Sarah Bexell, Chief Director of the Department of Conservation Education at the Chengdu Research Base of Giant Panda Breeding, Chengdu, China. Thank you so much for being with us today. I thoroughly enjoyed visiting Chengdu and the research base. Hopefully, conversations like we're having today will help people to realize how important it is to save all species of the world because we're saving ourselves. This is Dr. Bernadine Cruz of The Pet Doctor. You're listening to us on Pet Life Radio. Thank you so much for listening. Please tune in again next week. We'll have more information on how to make you the best possible pet owner. Take care.
Pets can be a wonderful addition to your life because they're a member of the family. Keeping them healthy and happy is important. Pet Life Radio presents The Pet Doctor with veterinary media consultant and veterinarian Dr. Bernadine Cruz. Whether you have a dog, cat, reptile, or rabbit, you'll find answers for your pets straight from the vets. The Pet Doctor, on demand every week, only on PetLifeRadio.com.